Well, as I pointed out in the prayer, we may actually, depending a little bit on our discussions tonight, we may actually be finished with Sirach tonight. I've been just selecting from chapters, and those selections are winding down. So we have a few things from chapters 31, 32, and 35, and then we basically skip to the very end, the Litany of Creation and the Epilogue, so in chapters 49 and 50. I'm passing over a lot of material where Sirach goes through all of the Old Testament figures and in very poetic and vivid ways describes them, and it's all very beautiful, but it would presume a lot of knowledge that we may not always have in the room, and everyone had to go through and explain to you the historical significance of every single figure, and there's you know, a couple dozen of them in there, and it would, as I say, I think it would take us much too long to get through all that material to really appreciate it. So, with that in mind, I'm going to just be passing over those sections in our reflections. As you know, with 50 chapters, we're not going to get to every single one of them in a Bible study. So, with that in mind, tonight's material from chapter 31, we begin with some warnings on wealth. Who would like to read?
I will.
All right, Ms. Robin.
Mm-hmm. Keeping watch over riches wastes the flesh, and the care of wealth drives away rest. Concern for one's livelihood banishes slumber, more than a serious illness, it disturbs repose. The rich man labors to pile up wealth, and his only rest is wanton pleasure. Many have been ensnared by gold, though destruction lay before their eyes. It is a stumbling block to those who are at it for it, a snare for every fool. Happy the rich man found without fault, who turns not aside after gain.
Okay. Now, there's some thoughts here I want to discuss with you on this whole question of wealth and anxiety. And then it also mentions here the connection between wealth and sin. But before it gets into that question, I want to ask you, you know, just to ponder with me a little bit and then maybe add some of your own experiences regarding, you know, regarding this whole question of wealth. Now, we live, we're wealthy in a lot of different ways in the modern world in which we live. We're not just wealthy in terms of material possessions. I mean, think of all the stuff that we have. Even just our grandparents never dreamed of or never thought they could ever afford. One of the incredible things that happened around the early part of the century, last century, was that Henry Ford made the automobile affordable. I mean, until that time, it was something that only the extremely wealthy could afford. And then he brought up this assembly line process, and they were able to produce these vehicles for pretty inexpensive, and he provided automobiles basically to us, and people started getting around with them, and you know, I wouldn't say automobiles are cheap, but most people can afford, you know, the average person can afford, you know, have to have an automobile. Home ownership, you know, our grandparents' generation, you know, this was sort of a new idea. You know, most people just rented apartments, and the idea of home ownership was, you know, something that didn't seem quite possible. And as much struggles as we've had recently with home prices going so far up for a while there, now they're beginning to come back down to earth. But the idea of home ownership has gone way, way up in the last 100 years. I mean, remarkably up. You know, so we begin to see that a lot of little trinkets we have, these electronic devices, that, you know, when they first come out, they're like $3,000, and they go all the way down to $39.95, and they're blister packed and hanging on the Woolworth, you know, on the thing. It's amazing how, in a way, many, many very, very sophisticated and powerful things are available to us. We have access to lots of things, comfort, air conditioning, lights, plumbing, indoor plumbing. I mean, again, our grandparents and great-grandparents, these were just dreams to many of them. They'd never thought of air conditioning to begin with, but again, indoor plumbing, just all of the stuff that we just take for granted. Not only that, but we're rich in terms of our income. We earn lots of money compared to most people in the world, in America. But beyond money, we're also rich in choices. We have lots of alternatives and opportunities available for us. You go into just a typical, over here to the Safeway or the Harris Teeter, and walk in. Not just one can of olive, 50 different kinds of olives. Low sodium. Black olives, green olives, with pimento, without pimento, with the stone, without the stone. You know, salt in the salt water, in the clear water, you know, whatever. It's all there. It's there for you. It's a Vanity Fair. You can, and that's just olives. You know, every product has all these different things. You got the kosher olives. Don't forget about those. You got all that stuff. It's all laid out there for you. And think of all the things that are necessary to get those things to market. And I'm not just talking about the olive tree and the olive garden. I'm thinking about the parts on the truck that haul the olives. I mean, all the incredible things. But the choices that are available to us socially today. You know, 150, 200 years ago, most people never went more than 20 miles from where they were born. The choices of who they were going to marry, usually marriages were arranged in those days, but if you had any choice at all, it was probably a very small selection. You probably met very few people other than the people you grew up with, and you know, you basically lived in a very isolated situation. As far as job opportunities, if your father was a farmer, you were probably going to be a farmer. If he was an ironsmith, you were probably going to be an ironsmith. If you were a woman, you were basically going to get married and bear children, and tend the home. I mean, the alternatives and the options were very small, very limited. There wasn't that much available. You basically had a pretty, what you may call circumscribed or very, very tightly woven life. You were basically going to live in with a small number of choices available to you, and there wasn't really all that much alternative. You couldn't go to a supermarket and buy 50 different kinds of sheets for your bed. You know, satin, silk, you know, this kind of weave, that kind of weave, whatever, you know. Okay, you get the point, right? So we have all of this richness. So let me ask you another question, though. With all of this, would you and I really describe ourselves as more anxious than our ancestors or less? Kind of. Yeah, I mean, maybe the word anxious, maybe stress. Stress. A lot of stress today, huh? In a way, there's too many alternatives. Life becomes extremely complicated. Lots of choices to make. But we're anxious about many things. Now, I'm not saying our ancestors were never anxious, but I think that with all this wealth and with all these alternatives available to us, I think, you know, you look at the people, how many people have to go into psychotherapy today, all the struggle that people have with anxiety, all the antidepressants that are sold, all of these things which are basically signs and symbols. A lot of people say a lot of the weight we carry is stress-related. A lot of people talk about a lot of other health concerns we have with blood pressure and all that stuff, very much stress-related, you know. I was thinking the other day, I'm waking up with my jaw real sore in the morning, and my molars, my back molars are sore. And when it happened to me a few years ago, I learned that I went to the dentist thinking I must have some kind of an infection back there. And he said, no, he says, probably what you're doing is gritting your teeth at night. You know, and I'm not grinding. I don't think I grind my teeth, but I'm clenching down while I sleep. And my jaw gets sore. It got so bad when I was first ordained. When I was first ordained a priest, I mean, I was nervous about everything. You know, first wedding, the first baptism, the first. Anyway, I had my carotid arteries got all swollen and painful, and they had to put me on heart medicine for a while to bring down the swelling in my carotid arteries. It was all stress. But again, I'm just trying to say to you is that with all of this, isn't that what this text is really saying? Keeping watch over riches wastes the flesh. We waste away anxious and concerned about wealth and riches. And I've got to find a security system. I've got to lock it. I've got to insure it. I've got to, you know, okay, et cetera. And then, you know, you are wealthy. You finally get all the wealth you want. And then now you got to get long-term care insurance so it doesn't all have to, you know. So if you end up going on Medicare or Medicaid, you know, they make you spend all your wealth down to about $2,000 and then the Medicaid kicks in or whatever, you know, all that stuff, right? So people run around buying insurance to insure their wealth and to insure their house and to insure their boat. And then security systems to keep it all locked up and monitored, and on it goes. We're anxious about many, many things. And so I simply say to you that what this text is saying is not far from our own experience, is it? Now, I just wanted to kind of, if you have anything you want to add to this discussion. Somebody once said to me who was poor, when I hear you rich people, and I was apparently a rich person to him, when I hear you rich people talk about how anxious your wealth makes, I said, I wish I could have that kind of anxiety for a while. but still, again, let's just look at the text. Keeping watch over riches wastes the flesh, and the care of wealth drives away rest. Concern for one's livelihood banishes a slumber more than the serious illness that disturbs repose. So again, anxious about money, wealth, jobs, promotions, lack thereof, all of that. Thoughts, comments? I guess it seems kind of evident, huh?
Mm-hmm.
All right. But we still don't learn the lesson, though, do we? Isn't it hard for us? Even when we really, like we are just now, we come out of a world gone mad, and we're in this room, and we're catechumen trying to get ready to come into the church. I mean, that's kind of the background. Like I said, the early church used this to instruct catechumens and some of the warnings about wealth. But even knowing this, we still want to be wealthy. And even though our experience tells us, we think, well, if I just get a little more wealthy, I'll be less anxious. Well, and then we're not. We say, well, if I were just to get a little more job security, then I'd be less anxious. Or, if I just had, whatever, fill in the blank, a new iPod, a new car, a new relationship, a better husband, a better wife, I wouldn't be so anxious. It was always one more thing. If we just got it, we wouldn't be anxious. And we never stop to think, part of the problem of my anxiety is all these things I do have. It caused me to be anxious and about many, many things. I don't know what would it be like to go back, get in the time machine, and go back to 400 years ago, or let's make it a little more recent, just so we're still in the United States. But even just to go back, 250 years ago, just before this country was founded. Now, let's presume, some of the folks in this room might not have this luxury to presume this, but you weren't a slave. But let's just presume you were just living, in a country setting, basically. In those times, most people didn't live in cities. Most people lived in rural settings, agricultural. I mean, how would you experience life? And remember, you've come from the 21st century, and the pace that we're living, And could you deal with the silence? The lack of interruption, cell phones, pagers, fax machines, email. Don't forget the text messaging now and all of that stuff. I mean, what would it be like to just spend 2 weeks, 3 weeks living that kind of a pace?
My parents just sent us down to my grandmother's after school, and we couldn't use the phone, it was long distance. She'd make cook everything at home, so we could go to school and steal candy. It was just a mess.
So after school you mean like for the summer?
For the summer.
Yeah.
For the summer down there. And we had
that's Southern Maryland?
No, she's 3 hours away from Virginia.
Okay.
Blue Ridge Mountain, that's where she lived.
All right.
She lived in the mountains.
Yeah.
And it was just hard. We had to make our own entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
The stars was out. You hide by that right star. I hide over there. It was devastating.
Right.
We made a calendar on the carport, and we was just asking every day. So we count down the time to come back to the city.
Wow. Yeah.
Stressful. Yeah. We should be relaxed and at ease. Now when I go down there as the older person, look at all the stars.
Yeah, right.
Quite the difference.
Yeah. It takes a while, though, to kind of get into that pace, even as an adult, doesn't it?
Yeah. Even as an adult.
See, we're very invested in the familiar, aren't we? Even though we know it's painful and difficult, and one more interruption, and of course, not only one more, but three more interruptions happen, and and we're just worn out. And yet, to actually go into a country setting or to go away from phones and TV and internet and everything is just, you know, climbing the walls time, you know. Every now and then, you know, I go on retreat and I'm like, what do you mean I got to be away from the internet? No, not thinking. That's unthinkable.
I think that has something, whether you appreciate it, and that has to do with how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think some of the older people would appreciate that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Probably does, yeah.
When I was growing up, since I'm maybe the oldest from the house that I lived in was like what you're describing. We didn't have any electricity. We didn't have water.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, we didn't have heat. So we had to, my cousin had to get up every morning and stuff the clothes, the stove, and get downstairs warm so that they could. So when I came downstairs, because I was a small child, and in order to have a bath, we had a big tin tub.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get water, we went to the fire hydrant on the corner to get water.
Wow.
No telephone, no electricity. We had kerosene lights and everything. So when you said go back 200 years, all I got to do is go back 50, 60 years.
Boy, you're old. No.
Right. Yeah, and the house is still there.
Right. Yeah, I even as a kid, I'm only 47, but even as a kid, I remember, of course, we didn't have computers like we did, cell phones, you know, any of that stuff. And we had to kind of make up our own fun, have our own games, you know. We did have TVs, but we still went out and played. I remember we built forts and tree forts, and we played, you know, German Spotlight at night. And, you know, we had little ways of keeping ourselves entertained. But it was a very different pace, a very different world.
I think in those days too, the families may have been closer because we would listen to once we got the electricity and listen to the radio together. But before that, the older people sitting there would tell you stories, and you know, I think this is how the family history gets passed down.
Right.
Because that's all you have to do.
It's not happening now. A lot of people lament the loss of the community around St. Cyprian's, you know, and it's interesting when you go back. And you hear some of the folks talk about life around C Street there, but at some point they point out in the history of Walter Street that somewhere in the 50s people began to pine for the bigger suburban houses, and these little houses in the city were feeling cramped, and you know, and so on. They wanted the bigger houses in the suburbs, so they all one by one left and went to the suburbs to follow the American dream. And now people remember, gee, what we lost something. We lost that kind of sense of community and neighborhood. And so it's just, again, all of these are just things to think about. But I almost guarantee you that most of us don't really know a way to stop. You know, even though we can encounter a text like this, it's very, very hard for us to really internalize it to such a degree that we really change our life and don't continue to pine after one more thing or a little more wealth, or a little more of this, or a little more of that, and think that we'll be happy. And we know from our own experience that really, in the end, wealth brings more anxiety, not less. And yet, we still want to be wealthy. We still want it. Just something to ponder. And again, part of our, you know, again, we've kind of gotten away today from thinking about a lot about our own sinfulness or our own stubbornness. But this is maybe one of those better areas to reflect on, that knowing all this, we still want to be wealthy. That's, again, it's a pretty good sign that we really need a savior. We really need someone to break through these really set in our ways stubborn attitudes that we have. And even though we intellectually know, yet our heart is still yearns and pines after things that we know in the end, bring us more grief and more trouble and more difficulty. Someone said to me, I really could have one of those Star Trek transporter rooms. And then I have to sit in traffic all day. Okay. But follow me for a minute. You know what I'm talking about? I shouldn't presume everybody knows what I mean by a Star Trek transporter room. What's that?
I don't know what you mean.
Well, you know, in Star Trek, they would go down to the planet, they would step in this little booth, and it would dematerialize them and rematerialize them on the planet.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the transporter room. They don't have to get a little ship and fly down to the planet. You beam down.
Okay.
You beam down. Okay, you got it?
Beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah, beam me up.
Okay.
So they dematerialize and rematerialize the machine. But anyway, Somebody said, wouldn't it be great if we had these transporter rooms and we wouldn't have to sit in traffic? And I says, no, listen to this. I'm a priest now. And people would find out that I was available. Could you come to France tomorrow afternoon and give us a retreat conference at the blah, 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 or whatever? And then I get another call from someone in Australia saying, we would like for you to come down and participate in, you know, our church conference on such and so. And then, you know, I get another, you know what I'm saying? I'd be beaming all over the planet. And remember, time zones and all that stuff. And so there's no more today, no more tomorrow, just constant demands. At 2 a.m. this time, I need to be over in Australia to give a talk to such and so, and then I need to beam back over to, you know, the space station and talk to the captain of the ship there and do a blessing of the new transporter room, and then beam over to North Dakota for a conference on whatever. You see the idea? We'd just be busier, wouldn't we? So it doesn't follow that the Star Trek transporter room would make us better off, you see. But if it became available, you know we'd want it. We'd all want one, the latest model, and we'd want to beam here and beam there. Before you know it, our life would be even more out of control and more interruptions and more demands, and then we'd all be saying, well, what about the good old days? But none of us would want to give up our transporter room. Did any of you want to give up your car? And if you want to give up, you know, your cell phone, your telephone, your anyone want to give up that? No way. And we know it hurts, and we know it's driving us crazy and making us anxious and putting unrealistic demands, but we still want it, and we still can't do without it. So I'm just saying to you, what a wretched man am I, okay, to go before the Lord and just say, I don't even know how to break the cycle. I don't even know. And eventually God will break the cycle. You know, he put us on our deathbed. And we'll have to let go of it all. And probably come to purgatory and spend about 10,000 years to be purged of all this stuff. And then we'll get to go to heaven. Okay. All right. Well, the other thing, of course, this text says is that it warns about wealth in the sense of that it's a cause for sin. Verse 6 there says, many have been ensnared by gold through destruction, though destruction lay before their eyes. You know, even though we know that wealth can be a terrible temptation, we still want it. To sin. We might even lose our salvation. It's a very serious temptation, but we still want it. It's a stumbling block to those who are avid for it, a snare for every fool. Happy the rich man found without fault, who turns not aside after gain. See, in other words, rare, not just happy, but rare, is the rich man. Jesus said, how difficult it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. You know what? We still want to be rich. Even though we know it may seriously impede and imperil our salvation, we still want to be rich. That is how deep our drives are for the things of this world, you see. So no matter what, we still want it. We're warned, God warns us, and so on, but still, we want it. Still, we can't do without it. Let me just read to you, I've read to you this text before. Paul writes to Timothy, and I've read you this text before, but again, since it's come up again before us here, let's read it. It says here, see here. We brought nothing into the world, just as we will not take anything out of it. Now, if we have food and clothing, we should be content with that. Those who want to be rich are falling into temptation and into a trap, into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men to ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all evils. And some people, in their desire for it, have strayed from the faith and have pierced themselves with many pains. All right. Same basic idea, isn't it, right? And yet still, we want it. Now, it doesn't say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. So, we all need some money. We need to get by in life. We need to pay our bills. We need reasonable things. You need to take care of your house. You need to keep it in good repair. You need to keep your car in good repair. You know, we need. So it's not money itself, but it's the love of money, the greed, the insatiable desire for more that really drives us, and it compromises us. And I'll say that in the church too, questions of money are a big, serious, money and power are big issues in the church that often keep us from preaching the gospel. As prophetically as we should. I think of priests who are troubled by, well, what if I say this to my parishioners? They might be upset, and so I might not get a good collection, and blah, 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 blah. They might call the bishop, and I might get to have to leave. And you know, so it's about money, popularity, and power, that some priests don't really preach the whole gospel. I think it's more of a problem in Montgomery County than in, say, a parish like this, you know, where I'm able to, I think, speak frankly to you. And my experience in the African American community is that people value prophetic preaching, even if it steps on their toes, Father. I won't be too specific, but I was with a couple of people from Montgomery County in a meeting yesterday, and they just aren't used to, you know. So I was talking about, we're getting ready for a catechetical program. I'm supposed to be doing a workshop for catechists on June 6th. And anyway, I was talking about prayer and basically saying, you know, I think what I want to say to the catechist at this point in prayer is that if you're not praying, don't teach. You're a danger. You shouldn't be teaching if you're not praying. If you're not praying, I don't want to hear what you have to say. In fact, you ought to leave right away. Now, you know, this is how preaching is done, you know? Right? A little hyperbole, a little exaggeration, but the point remains. It is a dangerous thing for a person who is not spiritual, who is not praying, to try to teach the faith. Well, one woman from Montgomery County raised her hand and said, "You can't talk like that. People get offended and they'll walk out on you." And I said, "Let them walk." You know, if they're not going to pray, if someone's going to be offended that I tell them they better pray, and if they're not praying, they should not be teaching, then they need to walk out of the room. Yeah. Well, Father, we need to use more honey than, you know, kind of this kind of look of astonishment. You know, but again, money, wealth, power. And some of my brother priests in Montgomery County especially really feel like they're walking on eggshells with their congregations about a lot of stuff. They can't talk about contraception, can't talk about abortion, can't talk about same, you know, stuff, can't talk about, you know, whatever. You know. Yeah. And gosh darn it, Father, heck with the collection, you know? I mean, preach the word, and, you know, but... You see, now that's at the local level, and then you start to get to the level of the bishops and the Vatican, and there's a lot of money and power and relationships tied up with that money and power, and you know, it has a very corrupting influence, you see. And Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. And he had nothing to lose, in other words, in saying, "Gosh darn it, this is the truth, walk in it or you'll go to hell. You're going to die in your sins." And he didn't have anything to lose. But unfortunately, when the church has money, power, and influence, we have a lot to lose. And so, zip it. Now, I'm not saying that I've ever received explicit instructions from a bishop or anyone to zip it, but there's a lot of pressure in large churches like ours to sort of, you know, schmooze and kind of walk a middle ground and, you know, just kind of wax and wane with the times and make people feel, you know, happy and included. And, well, all that's very fine, but in the end, like, gosh, money and power has a lot of influence on sometimes silencing the prophetic voice. And why? Because we have too much to lose. So I don't really rue the day when our tax-exempt status goes away. I'm waiting for it. I'm tired of this, "Well, we can't talk like this because we might, you know, lose our tax-exempt status." Catholic Charity saying, "Well, we can't explicitly announce Jesus because we accepted some federal money, and because of that, we can't explicitly announce Jesus." And I'm like, "Then skip the money." Yeah. "Well, no, you see, Father, we have to serve the poor, and we need the money." And I said, "But at what cost? When is Catholic Charities no longer Catholic Charities?" So a judge out in California said, "Well," he said, "I'm going to require Catholic Charities to provide contraceptives and abortion services to their in their medical plans because they although they say they're Catholic, there's nothing Catholic about them." Now, a secular judge ruled that way. And he says, "As far as I can tell, they never announced Jesus Christ. There's never scripture. There's no crucifixes. There's no religious articles or items on any of their social service areas. And they take federal money. And they explicitly sign agreements not to mention Jesus. So what is Catholic about Catholic Charities?" And frankly, I don't know what the answer is for that. He may, in fact, be Pharaoh telling Abraham to get back to the house of God, to get back to Bethel. Remember that story in the Old Testament? Abraham was worried about his hide. And so he put his wife up for prostitution in Pharaoh's harem. Pharaoh found out about it and he said, "Man, what have you done? You might have made me sin with your wife. Now you need to get back to where you belong." And he had left a place called Bethel, called House of God. And so Pharaoh is telling Abram to get back to God's house and to stop sinning. Well, I kind of felt that way when that judge issued that ruling on Catholic Charities in California. At some level, we've taken so much federal money and federal dollars that we're willing to accept instructions, not to mention the name of Jesus. Now, that's what I mean about wealth corrupting, you see. So it could be a priest in the pulpit in a church afraid to offend. So that might affect the collection plate or his influence with the bishop, because wealthy Montgomery County, I don't mean to pick on Montgomery County, you know, there's wealthy people everywhere. And it's not just wealthy people, but you see the point. It's very pernicious. Wealth does this. And then for all of us, you say, well, it's just about the church. No, it's about some of us too, who may belong to political parties and may be fairly high up in Republican. I don't mean all of us in the room, I'm just saying us collectively, but may be involved with political parties and fairly influential and moving up the ranks, and then the political party wants to take a position on a moral issue like homosexual marriage or abortion or what have you. Well, we're not going to say anything because we don't want to threaten our climb up the ladder. We're in a workplace and the boss tells us to kind of cook the books a little and play around with the numbers or cheat the customers somehow, and we're waiting for that promotion, we need the money, and you know, well, so we just go along. See, that's what I'm trying to say, and I'm not saying that's true of everyone in this room about any of those things. I'm just saying, though, we human beings struggle with this stuff, and it all comes down to the fact that we have too much to lose. All right? But the Son of Man had nowhere to lay his head, and now you know why. He didn't want to have anything to lose. Okay? You know, you have too much to lose. You're in serious trouble of sinning, is the point. You see the idea? Okay, that's what this text is saying. It's a very sobering text. It's saying, pay attention. Wealth causes you anxiety. It causes you sleepless nights. It makes you more anxious, not less anxious. You think, if I'm just more in control and I can use money and influence to control my environment, and you know, if I just have everything under control using money and all of the options I have available, I'll be less anxious, but in fact you're more anxious. So it's all a bunch of lies. It's money and it's going to make us comfortable and happy, and it's all a bunch of lies, and still we want it. And then we're told by Jesus, you know, it's difficult for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven, and we still want to be rich. And we, you know, that's fine, Jesus. That must be true for the next guy, because I can still be rich and still get to the kingdom of heaven. It won't happen to me. And then we begin to see how, again, wealth and riches and influences get into the church, get into ourselves as individuals, get into communities and into politics, and the whole thing begins to go south and becomes mixed up in corruption. You know, follow the money. Follow and see. And that's what this text is saying. And then, yet again, though, we're struggling because we all need money. You can't just live recklessly in terms of, you know, running around offending everybody and, you know, thinking you're going to keep a job. So we all have some struggles, don't we? You see, without compromising our fundamental beliefs and yet trying to make a go of it in the world, but realizing that sometimes the Lord required some pretty difficult things of us. There was a nurse that I knew back when I was at St. Mary's in Laurel, and she moved up the ranks. She became the head nurse of a very prominent hospital. That's pretty prestigious. You get your own corner office with a window, and you don't have to clean out bedpans anymore. You tell somebody else to do that, and you know, you get the big bucks, and you talk to the head doctors, and you schedule the scrub in with the big surgeries, and you know, it's pretty prestigious to be the head nurse in a major hospital. You got the idea? And so the hospital said, "Guess what? We're going to start providing abortion services, and we expect you to start scheduling nurses for these procedures." And she said, "No, I won't do it." They said, "Well, you're going to be fired if you don't do it." She said, "Well, I still won't do it." So they fired her. See? But, you know, she was sore tempted. She had a lot to lose, didn't she? See? But thank God she still made the right choice. But not everybody's that strong. A lot of wealth, a lot of power, a lot of prestige. I've worked years to get here, Father. Jesus will understand. Jesus, you take a number. I'll get back to you. When I'm retired, I'll be holy. But now I need to play the game. See, got to put food on the table. You understand Jesus, don't you? And the made-up Jesus says, sure I do. And the real Jesus says, if anyone loves father, mother, son, daughter more than me, they're not worthy. They cannot be my disciple. But the made-up Jesus says, I understand. Well done. It's okay. Go ahead. Schedule those nurses. Okay. Well, you get the idea, right? So, thank God she made the right choice. But, and by the way, the Lord was good to her. He gave her some, gave her another position. And maybe not quite as prominent, but well, she was happy. And so the Lord took care of her. All right. You get the idea? All right. Now, warnings about wine. Here we go, church. Let's. Now, just as a prelude to this, you know, some of the Protestants, not all of them, but especially the Baptists and others, you know, alcohol is intrinsic evil. It must always, it is not a drop of it ever. That is not what the Bible says. And you're going to see that here. There's a balance in this text. So let's read what this text says.
Listen to me, my son, and scorn me not. Later you will find my advice good. And whatever you do, be moderate, and no sickness will befall you. Let not wine drinking be the proof of your strength, for wine has been the ruin of many. Wine is very life to man if taken in moderation. Does he really live who lacks the wine which was created for his joy? Joy of heart, good cheer, and merriment are wine drunk freely at the proper time. Headache, bitterness, and disgrace is wine drunk amid anger and strife. More and more, wine is a snare for the fool. It lessens his strength and multiplies his wounds.
Okay, so, you know, all things in moderation is the basic advice here. And it starts out not just about wine per se,
right,
but things in general. Now, listen to me, my son, don't scorn me. Later you'll find my advice good. Now, again, young people, they love to just say, oh, you know, my father, my mother's unreasonable. They're just mean. They won't let me go out and be with my friends. Blah, 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 blah. You know, the same stuff. But most of us who have been reasonably moderate in our life, as we look back on the advice our parents gave us and the limits they set for us, in the end, we're grateful. We're grateful. But it pertains to young people to sort of shake their fist and say, it's not fair. All my friends get to do it. You know, that's the usual youthful folly, you know, and the youthful way of looking at things. But again, the text is very clear here. You're gonna thank me when you get older. All right. Now, in whatever you do, be moderate, and no sickness will befall you. So again, moderation. Now again, we all know this, not just about, you know, alcohol, but food. You know, we all know we're high blood pressure, too much salt, cholesterol, too much certain foods give cholesterol. We know that too much of certain foods is problematic. We know that too much food in general is problematic. And we know all these things, and yet, still there's struggles. But, not with me, of course, but I know with many of you. Yeah. Okay, I'm glad you get it. Now, the immoderation, you know, leads us to lots of problems. You know, we have huge numbers of health-related issues, and a great deal of our health issues today are behaviorally related. You know, in other words, our behavior has a lot of influence on these things. You know, again, high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol. A lot of dietary issues are surrounding these questions in our culture. Now, I think part of it, too, and I don't want to say, hey, it's not my fault, it's someone else's fault, it's the evil man, the man is doing something to me, the Martians are hitting me with rays from Mars, that's why I'm in the condition I'm in. Well, I don't want to go there, but there are some factors, I think, that we're beginning to discover as we look at the huge problem we're having with obesity in modern American and generally Western culture, and that is that there seems to be some relationship to all these processed foods that we eat. They're extremely laid down with lots of enriched, you know, wheat and flour and which is, you know, very sugary materials and lots of stuff. So even when we think we're eating healthy, we're still eating junk. And the junk starts to accumulate in our arteries and starts to accumulate around our waist. And we may think we're eating moderately. And, you know, when I was a little kid, my grandmother broke all the rules. And her generation, I mean, they had bacon and eggs and stuff for and breakfast, and you know, they love to get the marbly meat, you know, with all the fat on it. And I remember my grandmother always saying, "Oh, we'll get the marbly meat. We're gonna go get the marbly meat," you know, and she'd give me, "We're gonna fat you up a little with some marbly meat," you know, all that kind of stuff. And all the rules were broken, but in those older days, there weren't as many processed foods. You know, like for example, you try to buy pasta that's not enriched. That means it's full of all kinds of white flour, and that white flour is basically a sugar substitute. And you try to go and you get the really organic pasta, and it tastes a little bit less good. but it's better for you. But you know, you can eat more of that, whereas you can only eat a little bit of the enriched stuff without, you know, and suddenly you're over. And it isn't just even calories; it's just the kind of the way these sugars interact. So I'm just trying to say to you that I don't want to say, "Hey, it's not our fault. The man or these corporations are doing this to us." But we do need to kind of wise up, I think, and be a little bit more aware of not just how much we eat, but what we eat. And somebody told me, as you can see, I'm not all that good at it, but somebody told me to shop on the edge of the supermarket. You know, get the fruits, get the vegetables, don't get the can. Just get rid of canned vegetables, loaded with salt, just huge amounts of salt. So it's canned soups, canned anything, just sayonara. Fresh vegetables, frozen vegetables, you know, regular meat without, you know, canned and processed and pickled and God knows whatever they do to meat. But, you know, good real potatoes, not all the cardboard au gratin potatoes that are all processed and in boxes where you do something with them and they come out looking like real food, but they're really just fake. you know, stick to whole grain, you know, breads and not extremely enriched and processed wheats and flours. So that's the idea, you know. Now, I'm not saying we all do it. You can see that I still struggle, and I'm trying to work with the cook here a little bit and try to make better choices for myself. But in the end, I just think that we're all struggling with not just immoderation, but the type of foods that we're eating are extremely enriched with things that don't do well with our body chemistry. So, and I don't claim to be an expert in this, but I think there's a lot to that. Now, because again, my grandmother's generation, they did not eat less. I'm convinced they didn't. Now, they didn't maybe have as many Twinkies and, you know, these kind of junk foods as available in the old days, but I mean, I can remember some of the, you know, the big, you know, breakfasts and things that were constantly just regular fare, you know, in my grandmother's generation. Even when we were just kids, I mean, we really ate big breakfasts and big lunches and just lots of food, but it wasn't all the processed stuff. It was fresh, it was real food. Okay. Now, so moderation. And if you're moderate, no sickness will befall you. A little bit of an exaggeration, but the point is that so many of the illnesses that we struggle with today are related to our weight, to our fatty foods, to our salty foods, to our processed foods. Okay? So moderate is the idea. Now, it goes on to say here now regarding then wine. Now, don't try to prove you're a man by all the wine you drink. You know, that's basically what this text is saying. Wine is a wonderful thing in moderation, but it is a terrible slide to destruction in excess. It's basically the way. But notice what this text says, and it isn't just this text. You know, for example, the book of Wisdom and so on, the book of Ecclesiastes, other places say that wine is a gift to man from God. The Lord gave wine to cheer man's heart, says the scriptures elsewhere. So again, even though Protestants don't accept this text as biblically inspired, although it is, many other texts in the scriptures speak and praise wine as a gift from God. So let's not become teetotalers and shaking our fist and out there, you know, being abolitionist. I mean, no, that's the word I'm looking for, not abolitionist. The ones who wanted to... Prohibitionist. That's the name. Prohibitionist. A glass of wine is a beautiful thing. First of all, it's beautiful to look at. I mean, especially red wine, right? It calms you down a little bit. It makes you feel good. Relaxes you. One glass, you know, but two, three, four glasses, the room starts spinning. Start talking about stuff that you shouldn't be talking about, and tongue gets loose, and That's the old saying, in vino veritas, in the Latin, right? In wine there is truth. All right. So, again, notice what the text says. Wine has been the ruin of many, but it goes on to say, but wine is very life to man, if taken in moderation. Does he really live who lacks wine, which was created for his joy? So, again, it's a great gift, in moderation. But otherwise, the floor keeps hitting in the face. And it's really problematic, right? So, again, was it Benjamin Franklin who said, it is said, I've never been able to verify this, but Benjamin Franklin supposedly said, beer is a sign that God loves us and wants us to be happy. All right. So, anyway. So, it's a wonderful gift. A little glass of wine to relax you at night or whatever is fine. But it's the excess, right? And that's where I think that most Protestants are not with the Baptist on this, but to those who would, you know, just be, I would say, the kind of the extremist who would say that it's an intrinsic evil, so much so that I've actually had to have debates with some. I dated a Protestant girl once back in high school, and she used to insist that Jesus did not use wine at the Last Supper. Absolutely not. Her pastor was sure about that. He almost as though he had actually been there. He used grape juice. 100% pure grape juice. There was no alcohol in it. Jesus would never have done something evil. And wine is evil. Well, I said, but he made wine. No, he made grape juice. He used wine at the Last Supper. No, he used grape juice. How does your pastor know this? Because my pastor told me. The discussion was over. My pastor said so. Now, the same girlfriend would have said, you Catholics and your Pope, you think he's infallible. You Catholics and your Pope. And she quotes her pastor as though he were infallible. You see what I'm saying? So it's interesting. But when no one is Pope, everyone is Pope. So, anyway, but the point simply being is that I think that's absurd. Jesus clearly did make wine, normal wine. And he did clearly, the Greek text is not, there's no grape juice. It's wine. So, but anyway, and also, he certainly made wine in abundance for the feast, the wedding feast, and he used it at the Last Supper. So of itself, it's not an intrinsic evil. But, for some people, the only solution, if they're an alcoholic, is to stay completely away from the stuff. All right? But for those who are able to drink in moderation, it can be a gift, and that's the point. Okay. Now, any thoughts or comments on this? Have you had any discussions with Protestants yourselves about this whole question? Anyone? Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The whole question of when the flu comes around and stuff, should we suspend the cup and or do some other thing? And no one's required to go to the cup. You know, I guess you know that. Even though the text does say, "If you must eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you." But you know, when we receive the host, we're receiving the whole Christ, the living Christ. And obviously, in a living body, the blood is with the body. So we receive the blood with the host. But the fullness of symbol is to offer it as Jesus did under the two forms. But so no one is, first of all, required to receive from the cup. Let's say someone's an alcoholic, and even a drop of the stuff will set them off. So they need to stay away. Someone's worried about flu, or has the flu, or a cold, or something, and don't want to share it, or they're anxious they're going to catch something. No one has to go to the cup. So that's the first thing, okay, to answer that. Secondly, again, I don't claim to be a doctor, but I've listened to doctors on TV. You know? but I do. I do know this, that much more do we get ill by a can contact than by any work with the mouth. Because first of all, the saliva is very acidic and a lot of bacteria can't survive. And of course, the wine has alcohol. Even after it becomes a precious blood, the quote accidents remain. So I don't think this is likely. We're probably more likely to cause a problem when we do all this sign of peace and we're, you know, faces and, you know, handshaking and all of that's going on. And, you know, the easiest way to catch a cold is to touch the virus and then put your finger in your eye. Thing, you got it. I mean, that's, we always rub in our eyes and stuff like that. And apparently, I'm told by doctors, that's the surest way the mouth is not as bad and full of bacteria as we tend to think. So, not to say it can't be done at all, but it's not as common as, you know, people think. But we all feel, some of us have different levels of squeamishness about these things. So again, I would simply say that everyone is free to refrain if they think they need to, you know, from the cup. It's simply offered. It isn't required because the host contains already, you know, that which is, you know, for us. Okay? So I would quickly just answer that. Okay. Again, it just simply gives a warning about the immoderate drinking. I don't think we need to go further. We've certainly struggled with this in our culture. I will say this. I want to say regarding the priesthood, I've seen a lot of reform in the priesthood. It was very, very common back in the 40s and 50s for alcoholism was a huge problem among priests, terrible problem. And we had, long before the sexual abuse scandal, we had these places cropping up all over the country, treatment centers for priests who were basically, you know, struggling with alcohol. And there were bad habits in rectories. You would go to any Catholic rectory, and there'd be a closet just set aside, I mean, just packed to the gills with every imaginable drink you could think of. Any combination, you know, you got it's all. I mean, Catholic rectories were legendary for their liquor cabinets, and it was a very common practice through the 40s and 50s, and really even through the 60s, for the old guys to get together. I mean, you know, in the old days, I should say, at 4 o'clock for happy hour, and then they sit down to dinner around 5 or 6. So I mean, and if they had evening appointments, some of them were a little. And it was a very common thing. And you didn't just drink a beer or a glass of wine. They were talking, you know, heavy duty liquor. I mean, we're not talking, you know, they're doing some pretty heavy stuff. See, so, and that's ended pretty much. You won't find that in Catholic rectories much now. Happy hour is almost non-existent. There's a couple of old geezers in the diocese that still have happy hour in their rectory, but that's pretty much over. And most of the younger priests drink a little wine or a little beer, but you won't find a lot of hard liquor, you know, in rectories. Just not that common anymore. So I just point that out to you, but, you know, it's just one of those things that had developed, and again, we had a kind of a wave of trouble with that, and the bishops really began to talk to the priest, and a lot of conferences about, you know, eliminating, you know, hard liquor and things like that in the rectories, and beginning to eliminate happy hours, and after a number of years of that, it's much better, I think, much better. I don't think you find nearly the degree of alcoholism in the priesthood that you used to, so I'm grateful for that reform. All right, warnings to the young.
Young man, speak only when necessary, when they have asked you more than once. Be brief, but say much in those few words. Be like the wise man.
Taciturn.
When among your elders, be not forward, and with officials, be not too insistent. When it is time to leave, tarry not. Be off for home. Above all, give praise to your Creator, who showers His favors upon you. He who would find God must accept discipline. He who seeks Him obtains His request. The sinner turns aside reproof and distorts the law to suit his purpose. The thoughtful man will not neglect direction. The proud and insolent man is deterred by nothing. Do nothing without counsel, and then you need have no regrets.
Okay. So again, a young man should learn to be more of a listener than a speaker. Now again, most young men in their 20s are extremely opinionated. That's part of the... But so that makes sense that this counsel would be given. You know, do more listening when you're with elders. Listen more. Don't be so bold in their presence. Listen, be more careful to listen to what they have to say to you. So that's a pretty good counsel for a young man. And be brief. Well, sorry. But say much in those few words. Be like the wise man, taciturn. Now, taciturn, I gave you the footnote there. We don't use that word much anymore. It means inclined to silence, reserved in speech. Okay? So again, this is especially advice to the young. Some of the lines that I eliminated earlier in the chapter to the elders were encouraging them to speak. I'm afraid that many of our older folks are more reserved in their speech than they should be. They need to go and correct young people. They need to speak to them. You shouldn't wear your hair like that. That's not good. You know, or you know, this is inappropriate behavior, etc. I think that we have lost. We're not passing on the wisdom to the young as much as we should. So I'm trying to encourage some of our youth leaders to be a little more outspoken with the youth. We're going to be working on that a little over the summer. Kind of ramping up to doing some evangelization, you know, regarding our young people. Our young people do not hear enough from us really clear and insistent direction. No, dear, that is not appropriate for you to wear that kind of thing at church. It's not to happen again. You know, well, but I feel like it's okay. Well, it's not, and you're not going to do it. You know, loving but firm and clear. No one's going to follow an uncertain trumpet. We just have to be clear. And I think what we sometimes have in our culture is that, again, very bold young people who speak their mind, and a lot of older people who feel intimidated and don't say much, or say, well, I don't understand young people today. Well, you better start. Better figure it out, because they need to hear from you. I don't understand the words they're using. I don't understand their language. I don't understand why they do what they do. Well, tell them anyway. You know, get in there and. But you see, again, it takes a little bit of encouragement. So again, to the young though, he says, speak only when necessary, and when they've asked you more than once, you know, tell us what you think, young man. You know, be brief, only a few words. Be like the wise man, taciturn. That is to say, inclined to silence. All right. When among your elders, do not be forward, and with officials, do not be too insistent. You know, respect to people in authority. So again, but again, isn't that the exact opposite of what many of our young people are at school to do today? And the sitcoms and everything, what are they? They're forward. You know what it means to be forward? Kind of an in-your-face. Hey, old man. You know, that kind of, that's being forward, you know. And that's very inappropriate and very unbiblical and very unbecoming. So, again, we have this advice. And then, when it's time to leave, tarry off, be off for your home. Now, I don't know exactly what's going on there culturally. I think in our culture, young people disappear as quick as they can. All right. But apparently in that culture, they tended to hang around a little more and so on. Above all, give praise to your Creator. Okay, again, at the heart of young man, if you really want to speak, make sure that God is on your tongue. You're praising your Creator. He would find God must also accept discipline. See, accept discipline. It says the sinner turns aside reproof and distorts the law to suit his purpose. See, again, now what goes on there? Well, again, turning aside reproof means that, you know, how dare you, old man? What do you know? You don't know what you're talking about. Don't talk to me, you old man. You know, that kind of, you know, where young people will sometimes just rebuke or grow angry or just reject the advice of elders and just pay no attention to it. And it turned him into a sinner. And then it says, distorts the law to suit his own purpose. Now, you know, come on, most of you know, teenagers are natural-born lawyers. You know this, don't you? I gave you that example before, but some years ago I was over here at the school and told the students, no talking, quiet, do your work quietly. No, but no talking. Now, I mean what I said, now no talking. So one of the girls starts singing. I said, what are you doing? And she says, I wasn't talking, I was singing. You know, distorting the law to suit her purpose, you see. Now, that's a silly example, but I mean, there's a lot of this, well, you didn't say this, you didn't say that, you said this, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. So, it's a tendency among all of us, but the young especially. The thoughtful man will not neglect direction. The proud and insolent man is deterred by nothing. So again, you want direction. You should seek it. you don't always like it when it's given, but there it is. We need it. So that's the vision of to the young. Now, regarding tithes and offerings, I don't think I need to speak to this congregation at length about this, but let's go ahead and read it.
Appear not before the Lord empty-handed, for all that you offer is in fulfillment of the precepts. The just man's offering enriches the altar and rises as a sweet odor before the Most High. The just man's sacrifice is most pleasing, nor will it ever be forgotten. In generous spirit, pay homage to the Lord. Be not sparing of freewill gifts. With each contribution, show a cheerful countenance and pay your tithes in a spirit of joy. Give to the Most High as He has given to you, generously according to your means. For the Lord is one who always repays, and He will give back to you sevenfold. But offer no bribes. These He does not accept.
Okay. You're not going to buy God off now. That's not why we pay our tithes, right? But, again, notice there's two distinctions, or two broad distinctions here between tithes and offerings. In another place he calls it freewill offerings. Now, what's the distinction? Well, the tithe, of course, is commanded. It's a tenth. It belongs to God. It comes back to God. It belongs to Him. It's taint of money, taint yours, give it back. It belongs to God. So that's, and it says here, therefore, you this you offer in fulfillment of precepts. Okay? Now, notice it says here that the just man's offering enriches the altar and rises as a sweet odor before the Most High. Now, the idea of enriching the altar, well, the church has needs. We have activities we have to engage in. We have things that we have to do. I have to pay the light bill, so we have lights on for this meeting. The beautiful church that we have, we need to maintain. You say, well, God doesn't care about beautiful churches. Yes, but we need them. You know, we need to be edified. The fact that we keep our church in good repair is a sign that God is an important priority in our life. You see, if the whole thing were just an afterthought, I suppose we could just worship, you know, down in some old moldy meeting room somewhere. But because we really care and God's a priority, we have a beautiful church and we need to maintain it. And I'm grateful, as I told you on Sunday, for your fidelity to the tithe that helps us to keep the house of God up. You know, so the idea of enriching the altar, making sure God's house is in good repair, that the church has the resources it needs to do in terms of serving the poor as well as providing services like we're doing tonight, you know, Bible study, Xerox paper, lights, air conditioning, whatever's needed, that the work of God can go on without a lot of problematic things coming up. So that's the idea of, quote, enriching the altar. Okay? Now, it says here, therefore, and then it goes on to talk about free will offerings. It says your fidelity to the tithe will never be forgotten. Okay? Verse 6. Praise the Lord's church, all right? In generous spirit, pay homage to the Lord, not sparing of free will gifts. Now, this is another distinction. Notice free will. This is not under command in the sense that you have a specific amount to give. But you are called, and we're all called, to give to the poor, to be generous to those in need. Now, the poor can be defined or seen in different ways. Sometimes the poor are just your own children. Your children need your money. Your children need your support, or maybe grandchildren. It could be people we don't know. We give to the Archbishop's Appeal, and they serve people we've never met. It could be someone, a family member or a friend who's without a job, and you're helping them through this tough time and helping them with some of their bills. Whatever it is, but the Lord expects that of us. Now, He doesn't give you an exact amount, so it's a free will offering, but you ought to be generous. And the text goes on to say, with each contribution, show a cheerful countenance, and then also pay your tithe in the spirit of joy. Give to the Lord as He has given to you, graciously, according to your means. For the Lord always repays. He'll give you back sevenfold. Pay attention, church. All right? So, but offer no bribes. You're not going to buy God off. So God is going to not be outdone in generosity. He will repay. He will take care of you. I think most of us who've tried God out on the tithe have found that a lot of things came into order in our life after we started being faithful. He may not have always given you seven times the income, like this text is saying, but He might have repaid you in other ways. Maybe helped you to reduce some of your excessive spending, or may have helped you to be able to, other in other areas of your life. You see, that's the idea. Okay? Now, I think, again, we're pretty on board with this, so let's just finish up. We have a few more minutes. With a kind of a concluding, it's called the Litany of Creation and the Epilogue. Now, I'm not going to comment on all these texts. I want to, if I could, maybe, Robin, I'm going to go ahead and read this. But I'd like for you, as I read it, one of the things that we're missing today is wonder and awe. We live in a remarkable creation. Unfortunately, in our era, which is wonderfully scientific, I mean, we've gained enormous things from science. Medicine, science, we've been to the moon and back. That's not bad, you know. Pretty neat thing, you know. That moon's sweeping through there pretty fast, and all that stuff's going on. We still got there. We landed right where we're supposed to land, and we got back to Earth. That's pretty neat. All the medicine, all the science. Let's all be clear. Science is a wonderful thing, but this scientific mentality has tended to cause us to think of everything as a machine. And that somehow we're living inside of a machine, that all things can be explained mechanistically or materialistically. You know, so if you wonder at the beauty of a sunset, someone will say, well, there must have been a volcano, there's lots of ash in the sky, and that's what's causing the red sunset. Analyzing things to death. Instead of just saying, wow. See? And because we think we understand a few things, we think we understand all things. And we don't. In fact, do you know that scientists don't have a clue about how gravity works? Not a clue. It's a complete mystery. All they know is that objects attract. Why? How? Nobody knows. Are there invisible cords? Is there some force? We don't know. We can measure it, but we have no idea. And how common is gravity? Now, the Earth is spinning pretty fast. You ever been on a thing going around quickly? What happens? People fly off of it. They don't get pulled onto it, right? How is this that the Earth is spinning so quickly, and yet we're pulled to it and held onto it? By a pretty strong force. You know, gravity says as we get older, it gets harder to walk uphill. Gravity is a strong force. Where does it come from? Nobody knows. All right, so let's be clear. We've kind of lost our wonder and awe. Wow, ooh, ah. You know, it's all like, well, this means this is because of this. And this. It's, everything is mechanistic. It's like we're living inside a machine. No, you're living in a revelation of God. Creation is God's work, and it is a revelation. Now, with that in mind, I'm going to read this text. And we're not going to, there's a couple of lines I'm going to mention to you, but we're not going to spend, I just want you to experience the text, all right, rather than analyze it. So again, you might even close your eyes and just imagine these things if you want. You know, you don't have to, I'm just saying you might want to. All right? The clear vault of the sky shines forth like heaven itself, a vision of glory. The orb of the sun, resplendent at its rising. What a wonderful work of the Most High. At noon, it sees the surface of the earth. Who can bear its fiery heat? Like a blazing furnace of solid metal, it sets the mountains aflame with its rays. By its fiery darts, the land is consumed. Eyes are dazzled by its light. Great indeed is the Lord who made it, at whose orders it urges on its steeds. The moon, too, that marks the changing times, the governing of the seasons, their lasting sign, by which we know the feast and the days, fixed days, this light-giver which wanes in its course. As its name says, each month itself renews. Oh, by the way, you know moon and month? A lot of people don't hear that in English anymore. Moon, moon. What moon are we in? We pronounce it month. But the question is, what moon are we in? That's where we get the word month there. All right. The beauty, the glory of the heavens are the stars that adorn with their sparkling the heights of God, at whose command they keep their place and never relax their vigils. A weapon against the floodwaters stored on high, lighting up the firmament by its brilliance. Behold the rainbow, then bless its maker, for majestic indeed is its splendor. It spans the heavens with its glory, this bow bent by the hand of Almighty God. His rebuke marks out the path for the lightning and speeds the arrows of his judgment to their goal. At it the storehouse is open, and like vultures the clouds hurry forth. In his majesty he gives the storm its power and breaks off the hailstones. The thunder of his voice makes the earth writhe before his might, the mountains quake. A word from him drives on the south wind and the angry north wind, the hurricane and the storm. He sprinkles the snow like fluttering birds. It comes to settle like swarms of locusts. Its shining whiteness blinds the eyes, and the mind is baffled by its steady fall. You ever feel just hypnotized looking at the snowfall? I can look at it for hours as the snow comes down. He scatters frost like so much salt. It shines like blossoms in the thorn bush. Cold northern blast he sends to turn the ponds into lumps of ice. He freezes over every body of water and clothes each with a pool with a coat of mail. When the mountain growth is scorched with heat and the flowering plains as though by flames, the dripping clouds restore them all. And the scattered dew enriches the parched land. His is the plan that calms the deep and plants the islands in the sea. Those who go down to the sea tell part of its story. And when we hear them, we are thunderstruck. In the sea are its creatures, stupendous and amazing, all kinds of life, and the monsters of the deep. For him, each messenger succeeds at its bidding and accomplishing his will. More than this, we need not add. And let the last word be, he is all in all. Let us praise him the more, since we cannot fathom him. For greater is he than all of his works. Awful indeed is the Lord's majesty. And wonderful his power. Lift up your voices to glorify the Lord. Though he is still beyond your power to praise, extol him with renewed strength and weary not, for though you cannot reach the end. For who can see him and describe him, or praise him as he is? And beyond these things, many things lie hid. Only a few of God's works have we ever seen. It is the Lord who made all things, and to those who fear him, he gives wisdom. Again, a beautiful praise of creation. I love that. I even have a little card I came up with, God in Winter, where I talk about the snow like fluttering birds and the steady fall baffles the mind and all of those things. Beautiful stuff. So again, you notice there this beautiful vision of this passage from Sirach. Now, I gave you on the stapled page, I don't know if any of you are familiar with this hymn, O Worship the King. O worship the King, all glorious above. I sometimes go over late at night and play it in church on the organ. It's got a wonderful pedal part. Very, very well. I love to play the pedal part with my feet. But this is a poetic version of what we just read. And it's an old hymn from the Protestant church. But it's very similar. So it's beautifully because it's so poetic. O worship the King, O glorious above, O gratefully sing His power, His love, our shield and defender, the Ancient of Days, pavilion in splendor and girded with praise. O tell of His might, O sing of His grace, whose robe is a light, whose canopy space. His chariots of wrath the deep thunder clouds form, and dark is His path on the wings of a storm. The earth with its wonders, with its store of wonders untold, almighty thy power hath founded of old, established fast by a changeless decree, and round it hath cast like a mantle the sea. Thy bountiful care what tongue can recite, it breathes in the air, it shines in the light, it streams from the hills, it descends to the plain, and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. Frail children of dust and feeblest frail, in thee do we trust, in thee, and nor find thee to fail. Thy mercies, how tender, how firm to the end, our Maker, Defender, Redeemer, and Friend. O measureless might, ineffable love, while angels delight to worship thee above, thy humbler creation, though feeble their lays, with true adoration shall sing to thy praise. So there it is. Beautiful, beautiful little hymn. Wonder and awe. Do you ever just take time? You know, one of the things that we miss, I think, living on the East Coast and in the modern age where there's so much light, we don't see the stars. We might see occasional, the really brighter ones. I think I might have told you this, but one time about 10 years ago, I was in North Dakota. It was in the middle of winter. There was no humidity or anything. It was about 22 below, 25 below zero. And decided to go out for a walk. There was no wind. It was very calm that night. And even as cold as it was, you just bundle up and and a priest friend of mine, we both went out for a walk. And in that part of North Dakota, there's almost no lights, just farmland. And got away from the house and the light in the house and looked up and I said, is there like a cloud up there coming overhead? And he kind of looked at me. He said, no, there's no clouds out tonight. No clouds. I said, well, what is that? It looks like a cloud, kind of a big belt cloud. He said, oh, he said, kind of laughed at me. And he said, well, that's the Milky Way. And that was the first time I'd ever really seen the Milky Way. And now he says, well, that's why they call it the Milky Way. Because it looks like a milky white cloud. That's how zillions and zillions of stars that create almost a cloud-like effect, a belt right through the middle of the sky, and a little darker on each side of it, but the Milky Way. And it's a remarkable display of light at night. And you just never see it on the East Coast. It's not done. So if you ever get a chance, you know, if you're ever in far out in the desert, southwest, or somewhere where you can get away from the lights and look up on a less humid and uncloudy night, just behold, it's an incredible vision. And all the ancients experienced that all the time. They didn't have lights in the ancient world, so they would look up every night and they would see the stars, and they were in touch with the stars, and they understood the moon and the cycle of the moon. That's where we get the word month. What month are we in? What month? They all the constellations, and they were very, the ancient, even very simple peasants who could look up and tell you, well, that's Orion, and that's that's whatever, that's Pleiades, and they just knew these things because they saw them all the time. Stars? Oh yeah, those things up there, you know. There's a wonderful movie that I did a commentary on, a movie that came out about 10 years ago called Blast from the Past. And this family went into a bomb shelter in 1962, thinking that an airplane crashed near their home, and they had this incredible bomb shelter they built of many rooms, and it was a remarkable thing. And they set the locks for 35 years. And they lived in this bomb shelter for 35 years, and then they, at the end of the 35 years, the locks came open when theoretically the radiation would have dissipated and they could go safely out. And the young man who's in the movie was actually born in the bomb shelter. He'd never seen the outside world. He'd seen films and pictures and all of the stuff in the bomb shelter. But anyway, he walked out and came out. He went, ah! He looked up at the sky, and it was, ah! And people were walking on the street, kind of looking at him, and said, look, look! And they said, and what? What? The sky! It's right in front of you, and you don't even see it. And you know, the sky! And then he sees the ocean for the first time, and he runs into the ocean, and can't believe his eyes. You know, he's just thunderstruck at the majesty of creation, and we just like, oh. What's on TV, you know, I mean. So the idea here is wonder and awe. Don't miss the color purple. We talked about that last time, right? Remember? Don't miss the color purple. You know, God gets angry when we go through a field and miss the color purple. Because He did that for us, and we walk right by it. Okay? So, all right. Well, just a quick epilogue, and then we have a prayer and a farewell. The epilogue. Wise instruction, appropriate proverbs, I've written in this book. I, Jesus, son of Eleazar, son of Sirach, as they gush forth from my heart's understanding, happy the man who meditates on these things. Wise the man who takes them to heart. If he puts them into practice, he can cope with anything. For the fear of the Lord is his lamp. Okay. And again, what is the fear of the Lord? That God is at the center of your universe. God is at the center of your life. Not on the periphery, not someone you see on Sunday or occasionally hear about on Ash Wednesday or Palm Sunday, but He's really at the center of your life. You fear Him in the sense that you revere Him. You want to learn from Him, study His ways. This is the fear of the Lord. And if you live this way, says the Lord, it will be just fine. And so again, that's the challenge. Now remember, we've been catechumens coming out of a world gone mad. The church wanted to instruct us. And when they did, these catechumens who came to knock on the door of the church back in the 3rd century, St. Cyprian's day, they'd say, hey man, you're so messed up, we've got to take you through some ways of thinking about your thinking. And they would use the book of Sirach, and that's what we've done. So I hope that some of these things stick. And that there is some value in what we've done. So we're finished with this book. And So we'll end here. I'll just turn off the recording.